The unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect truth is seldom met with, even in 100,000 myriad kalpas. Now we can see and hear it, we can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. So before we start, I wanted to thank Reverend Master Mayon for asking me to make a Dharma offering on this Sunday, our beginning of Jukai, and to thank all the monks here for helping me to live in this monastery, no small feat, and to thank all of you for coming today. Thank you very much. I thought I would like to share with you some thoughts I had on gratitude and karma. The karma is always there, the gratitude isn't always there, and I thought that that distinction might be worth talking about. So I've written some notes out, and I hope you'll forgive me for reading sometimes. It occurred to me that at times our ordinary daily life can be so bleak that asking for help seems far beyond our reach. And I think this is caused by fear and inadequacy and judgment and self-criticism, and they can all seem bigger than we are. And it occurred to me maybe that's where the term overwhelmed came from, because sometimes we just feel overwhelmed. And so the downward spiral continues, and it grows, and it grows, and it grows until something happens. And it's that something that I wanted to offer today. I went through one of those periods not too long ago, and it lasted about 4 months. And need I say, it felt like 4 years. And I won't go into all the details, but one of the things that came up for me when that was happening is, well, maybe it's because I've been out of the monastery, you know, and you go away from your sitting place, whether it's your office or your home or your monastery or whatever it is, and I think it's the grass is greener syndrome. And you get back and you think, oh, well, here I am again. And it's true, here you are again. And it's a question of what you do with that again and what you do with that being back. When I was thinking about this from hindsight, the word acidi came up for me, which is a word that I had heard Reverend Master Chiyu use in my early years here. And when I looked up the meaning in my bound paper printed dictionary, it says apathy or indifference or not caring. It's a term that especially has been used, so I understand, in medieval monastic life, and it means spiritual torpor. There's also a little bit of self-indulgence there. You get yourself in that place where you don't seem to be making any progress, and there's no brightness, and it's all darkness, and after a while, it sort of becomes comfortable, as miserable as it is, and you just kind of sit there in it. For me, it was the not caring that was the most painful, both not caring for myself, you know, the standard phrase is, I really don't care whether I live or die. Well, of course, we all care whether we die, but the self can say that to you, I don't care whether I live or die. And I think this came from all the years of training. What was the most painful was not caring about others and not being willing to say yes. So it seemed to boil down to not wanting to be here, not wanting to be exactly where I was. And given all the time I've been here and all the struggles I've been through, it now, looking back on it, doesn't seem to make much sense. But it was very real to me at the time. And I think that that feeling of not wanting to be here is not limited to monastic life. Because I can remember quite clearly after all these years, periods much the same in a job that I had. You know, I had to support myself, but I certainly didn't want to be doing this. Well, then why did I take the job in the first place? I was lucky enough to have choices of jobs. I think it happened in my pre-monk marital life. I certainly didn't want to be here with this particular person. Even at university, even as a parent, you have less choices as a parent, but you can sit there and say, maybe I can adopt him out or something. Not that I ever seriously thought about that, but, you know, there are times. So I think what I've learned can apply to all of us in whatever life situation we find ourselves in. And when we're in that situation, in that hole, we find we're not able to do the things that we all know to do, that our training has said to us, look up. Always look up. Well, I would look up, except I'm looking down, and you can't do both at the same time, and I'm just going to sit here and look down. To take refuge. Well, what would I say to someone if I said to another monk, can I come and talk with you? What is there to talk about? Bowing. You know, our training always says to bow to circumstances. Well, bowing means a willingness to step outside yourself and a willingness to see something greater than yourself. And at the very depths of what I was going through, that perspective wasn't there. Another of our teachings is look at any circumstance as a gift and to ask ourselves, what is there for me to learn here? Well, this didn't feel like much of a gift. And I wasn't willing to, or able, maybe both, to see what was happening as a gift. I just kept looking at, I don't want to be here, I don't want to be here, I don't want to be here. And when I'd ask myself, well, okay, Scholastica, where would you like to be? The Caribbean? No. Would you like to travel to Europe? No. Would you like to move in an apartment of your own? No. So you're kind of stuck, aren't you? You're in this hole. You don't want to be here, but there's no place else you want to be. I mean, I'm a rational human being, and that doesn't make any sense at all. So I think at some point, what started to come up was to recognize another teaching that we've all been told and hopefully have absorbed, that all things, all conditioned things arise, abide, and pass away. So at some point, this was going to pass away. It didn't seem like it was any time in the near future. I was also in great misery over the fact that in place of gratitude, there seemed to be only criticism and ill will. I could find fault with everything and everybody, without doubt. And the ill will that arises at that point, I think for most of us, certainly for me, really made me physically ill. And I think that that's what karma does, that there's a mental component, there's our thoughts, there's our speech, and then it kind of grabs you in the gut and twists, although it may not be the gut. Some people have headaches and some people have all kinds of various things, but there will be a physical component to it. And this was very difficult, to not be able to find any gratitude in the situation, because gratitude is one of the basic foundation stones of our practice. Great Master Dogen in Shishogi and Reverend Master Jiyu in Volume 1 of Roar of the Tiger speak of gratitude as an integral part of our daily practice. Dogen says, our daily life should be spent constantly in selfless activity with no waste of time whatsoever. And Reverend Master Jiyu says, gratitude flows from within like a river, the water of the eternal, the water of the spirit, Kanzian pouring out the water of compassion. It's also the water of gratitude. So, what does one do when all of that teaching appears to be totally absent, totally void from one's body and mind, when everything seems remote and not at all doable? Well, fortunately, we don't lose our meditation, and we don't lose our mindfulness, and we don't lose our perceptual awareness. Now, these may seem diminished or weak or on a fairly wobbly footing, but I found that the basics were still intact. And that was very encouraging in the midst of all the discouragement. So, the days continued to unfold with or without me. That seemed to be what was happening. Regardless of what I did or didn't do, you know, the sun rose in the morning and the day happened, and then night came and night went and there was another day. And the misery grew, and of course when we don't want to be where we are, wherever you happen to find yourself, it's very difficult to be at ease with your body and your mind. And it just seems to get worse and worse and worse. Fortunately, very, very fortunately, I didn't have a handy way out. I mean, I could have got up and left, but where would I have gone, you know? And I can think back to, as I say, in the world before I came to the monastery, well, I could walk out of my job today, but then where would I be, you know? I could walk out of the house. My husband would come home and find it empty, but that wouldn't help much, you know. But I really leave my child. All these things where you don't have an out, and you feel up against the wall, and you feel there's no place to go, and it's a very, very good thing. Because one day, the niggle from very, very deep within managed to get a word in edgewise, and I found myself saying, maybe what is needed, it isn't going out there, it's coming in here. It's looking within. And it was such a simple thing to realize. And the self wanted to jump up and down and say, well, dummy, you could have thought of that 4 months ago, right? But fortunately, the self was so overwhelmed with this wonderful insight that the place to go wasn't out there. It was in here. And I realized that there was something that was calling desperately to be heard. And of course, what was calling to be heard was karma. And what's come up for me is that cleansing karma seems to be a lot like mending your knickers or your t-shirt, right? You have this little hole, and it needs attention, but it's a very small hole, and you've got other things to do, and you just don't have the time to find the thread and the needle and thread the needle and start stitching. But eventually, you think, oh, I'm going to take care of that. I'm going to sit down and do that. And of course, by the time you get around to it, the hole has grown a lot larger. It's grown a lot larger, and it takes a lot more time. So here I was, with no place to go but home. Home in the sense of right where I am, right where we find ourselves. And so there I was, looking within and sitting still, and asking for help. And as I looked, being incredibly frightened and scared and sometimes terrified and often tearfully, at what arose, the fog actually started to lift, and I began to see some buried karmic patterns that I could relate to past and current patterns of speech and thought and behavior. And since then, there are several teachings that I've come across that have actually clarified what was going on and have helped me to think about what to do in future when that desolation of the mind occurs, because that's what it seemed to me. You know, the meaning, the definition of desolation is forsaken and abandoned, and that's what it felt like. That's what exactly what it felt like. So at some point after that, when it started to lift and, quote, normal life seemed to be recurring, I came across a lovely article by Reverend Master Maitin, and she's up in Victoria, B.C., and this was the autumn 2014 issue of the OBC Journal, and she has an article called Layered Karma. I'm going to read you some of it. The willingness to be still within the discomfort involved here allows little by little a recognition of how karma works. There are patterns of cause and effect that to varying degrees have escaped our notice through the automatic conditioning coming out of past experiences. When the teaching about karmic consequence has been overlooked and forgotten, life generously provides repeated situations to get our attention. The compassion of the eternal. The compassion of the eternal. When something escapes our notice, and we need to take notice of it, there will be repeated situations to get our attention. And indeed, that was what was happening for me. Reverend Master Maitin continues on. Enter the title of this reflection, Layered Karma. What one begins to recognize, and this can bring a profound humility right up front, is that buried in the storehouse of this body and mind we take as self are old patterns that surface when the right conditions come together at a particular time. With the cultivation of awareness itself, there is a better chance to see the connection. So when things arise that are disconcerting, that are frightening, that are scary, we need to stop and say, there is something here for me to pay attention to. And we need to pay attention. There's a nice analogy in the scriptures about our practice being as removing a cataract, and that the obstruction of old conditioned ways of being in the world is like a cataract. And with training, you finally start to remove that. And the blurriness goes away. And we begin to see things clearly. And we say, oh, I never thought of that. Oh, that's what that means. And then we can use our training to turn ourselves around. And as she says, we're less slaves to the habit tendencies that automatically blind our awareness. So it's thinking of karma as habit. You know, these are the habits. My patterns of speech, my discomfort with this particular person, my unwillingness to do this, that, and the other thing. There's karma underneath of there, and we need to look at that. And she concludes by saying, when we finally get it, we appreciate Dogen's rather stark observation, there is only one thing to train hard, for this is true enlightenment. The training hard is working with the koan that appears in daily life. It's as simple as that from the side of practice, and as difficult as that, when we are more or less sleepwalkers moving through life in old habit patterns that are automatic. So don't underestimate the staying power of karma and the help of the eternal in offering us a way to accept it, and look at it and cleanse it. So, what did I learn from all this? Well, I learned a lot. But I'm only going to talk about three of them. Three of the things I learned. And that was sitting still, acceptance, and gratitude. None of these, of course, are new to you. But it's interesting how something that's kind of old hat, oh yeah, everybody talks about that. I pick up a scripture book and everyone, you know, there's the teaching. But there's a time in our lives where it becomes new for us, where there is something new to learn. And firstly, I learned that, this is one of those duh moments, I learned that the practice actually works. That sitting in meditation, sitting still, keeping the precepts, well, by golly, it works when you need it. Probably works when you don't need it, but it also works when you need it. And I think it's the faith that sitting still, even when what we most want to do is jump up and down and holler and scream and go somewhere else, anywhere but here, but just continuing on, just going on is the important thing. Being willing to be willing, making even the teeniest of effort, letting the stillness tell us that being imperfect is okay. And I had already written in my little daily journal sometime before that, it's okay not to be perfect. But of course, I didn't remember that during the 4 months. I don't have a refrigerator in my room to put things on, but I think somehow I'm going to write that out. And maybe I'll put it somewhere where I can see it. I think being willing to be not afraid, to be willing to not worry, and to realize that truly all will be well. We were having tea the other night, and one of the monks reminded us is that there's that wonderful saying, don't worry, all will be well at the end. And if it's not well, it's not the end. And I thought, that sounded pretty good to me. Now, you can only take that so far, because at some point, there is going to be an end. And so we need to train to look at the fact that we want things to be well at the end. And actually, I think even at the end of our lives, if we have the pure intention of all acceptance, of gratitude, that all will be well. Our death may not be what we want it to be. It may not come when we want it to be. But all will be well. So what was the second thing I learned? So the second thing I learned was all acceptance. I could be right about what I thought was going on, but I also could be wrong. And that's something that all of us have learned from Reverend Master Chiyu. And for me, I interpret it as a willingness to put my mind's camera in panoramic mode. So to be able to look at the big picture. Reverend Master Chiyu calls the big picture the kaleidoscopic mind. And she uses that term both in describing our interactions with others and as an instruction for our interior interactions. In other words, how can we get ourselves out of our narrow, self-serving, and most times completely erroneous view of ourselves? I'm going to read you a few sentences from two very nice passages in Volume 1 of Roar of the Tigress. And on page 190, she talks about the kaleidoscopic mind. And she reminds us that whatever we look at, the person sitting next to us is going to see it somewhat differently. If we all turned around to look at the clock, we would all see it from a slightly different view, because none of us are sitting in the same place. And none of us have the right to say, oh no, actually your view of that is wrong. And what she says is, the kaleidoscopic mind, as Dogen calls it, is all important. the willingness to be able to see other people's opinions, to understand other people, and to have sympathy. Realize that other people have the right to their point of view. The fact that one person calls it God, and another Allah, and a third the Eternal, or XYZ, that's all right too. So we have to remember that while we're sitting here looking at things one way, other people are going to see things other ways. And if that's true, then it's also true that the state we find ourselves in dictates our perception. And that's not the only perception that we have. And she actually uses kaleidoscopic mind in this sense of an interior perception when she says, "You see the world as if through an ever-changing kaleidoscope that can see the Buddha in everything. This is what is meant by the line in our morning service scriptures, which says, the wooden figure sings and the stone maiden dances. And the fence posts sing and dance, and they all glorify the Eternal. To be able to see the Buddha nature in all things, to be able to see the Spirit in all things, this is what is meant by enlightenment. The thing that matters most in looking within is doing something about you, doing something about the inner wall. You built it, you pull it down. You made the mess of it, you have to clean it up. If the pond is muddy and you can't see the moon of Zen, it's because you polluted it. In this day of environmental concern, you should get the point of that loud and clear." So whatever state we find ourselves in, if we are able to accept that state and sit still, what will arise for us is being able to see a different perspective. In the depths of our despair, our anger, our inadequacy, our resentment, whatever it is, to look with the eyes of a Buddha, that's compassion. Looking with the eyes of Buddha is unconditional love. And this is our practice. Regardless of how up or down we feel, the practice is always there and it supports us. So that remembering the kaleidoscopic mind is very important, because we can make use of it in both our interactions with other people and our interactions with ourselves. Remember, we train for self and we train for others, and accepting our imperfect selves is part of all acceptance. So the third thing that came up for me was, when in doubt, practice gratitude. Even when it's half-hearted or it seems insincere, during the darkest period of that time, I found myself being quite aware that actually, in spite of not wanting to be here and in spite of wanting to be there, that I was really very fortunate to be here. Because if I looked at where I am and I looked at the world, there was a lot of the world that I would prefer not to be in. When I read and hear about the animosity and violence in the world, not just in Syria and Iraq, but in this country too. A lot went on a little while ago, recently, about the 50 years since the March to Selma, and civil rights. Well, I was very much involved in that. Well, 50 years haven't resolved our racial problems in this country at all. And I think most of us know the details of what's happening here in this country and what's happening in other countries. You know, when we feel a separation, whether it's a religious separation or a racial separation, we no longer see the Buddha nature in all beings. So I was thankful that I was here, that I wasn't causing great harm to people, and I knew that I had to look at the situation that I was in. And I think it was that gave me the space I needed to actually look deeply and without reservation at what needed to be looked at. And what this now means for me is a new way of looking at personal karma. I look at karma now as it's not who I am, it's what I have. It's what I have to work with. And that's true for us, whether we're monks or lay people, whether we live in a monastery, whether we live in the world, whether we have a job or families, whether we're in school, whether we're unemployed, no matter what we are. You know, our personal karma influences what we say, what we think, what we do. But it's not who we are. Who we are is a Buddha nature. Who we are is compassion, love, and wisdom. What we have is this messy, smelly block of karma to deal with. And isn't it wonderful? Because if we didn't, we'd all be out reading movie magazines and eating bonbons or doing something equally frivolous, right? Watching Vines, you know, the new internet thing. So I was very grateful for having this desolate space that kept me bound up for so long. Another article that came to me after all this happened and that seemed so relevant was an article also in the same issue, Autumn 2014, Journal of the Order of Buddhist Contemplatives. And this was by Reverend Oriana, who is the prior up at Eugene Buddhist Priory. And it's called Some Thoughts on Gratitude. And she says this much better than I could say it, so I'm going to read it to you. Gratitude goes beyond dark and light, beyond yes and no, beyond getting our way or not getting our way, beyond having or not having. Gratitude for the ongoing flow of life and that we are part of it, part of the universal. Gratitude for existence when it is sad and when it is joyful. Are we able to be grateful for things just as they are? That's a hard one. I think it's a good question to ask ourselves. Am I able to be grateful for the way things are right now, today? And then she continues, can we be grateful for the hard things in our life? Shunryu Suzuki Roshi said that how we suffer is our practice, not why we suffer, but how we suffer. She continues, what do we do with difficulties? Can we know gratitude in the face of suffering? One Zen monk said, I don't say, why me? I say, why not me? And what I understand from that is that when we say, why is this happening to me? We're separating ourselves from every other being. You know, why is this happening to me? Well, if it's going to happen, it happens to somebody. So if it's not happening to me, does that mean I'd rather have it happen to one of you? No, no. So I like the don't say, why me? I say, why not me? Why me means we see ourselves as separate beings among many beings, avoiding the painful, seeking after pleasure. With why not me, we know we belong with everything and everyone. There is no separation. We may think there is, but in truth there isn't. Gratitude is wide enough to cover our own suffering, and it is powerful enough in difficult times to ground us in our connection with all beings. How we suffer is our practice. Suffering can lead us to awareness, patience, compassion, and generosity. Can I be thankful for this experience? It's a small question, 7 words, it's a big, big question. Can I be thankful for what I'm experiencing right here and right now? Can I see that gratitude has no boundaries? And Reverend Oriana concludes by saying, Tibetan Buddhists have pithy slogans as a ground for training, and one is, be grateful to everyone. Can we be grateful to troublemakers because they blow our cover? They expose us, encourage our hidden stuff to be present, show us where we're stuck. Can we really be grateful to that person that's saying, did you really mean what you just said? It takes a lot of courage to be grateful to those who drive us crazy. Can we still feel what we feel, acknowledge it, and have gratitude? Dharma practice is to find a way to work with what provokes us. Don't try to make what provokes you go away. Study it. This is how we wake up. Embrace it. Embrace our karma. That's what we need to do. Not to push it away, to embrace it. She continues, can we keep our heart and mind open in the midst of difficulties? Usually, difficulty is where we close down, shut off, and keep the cycle of misery on the planet turning. Because remember, we train for self and others, and our misery isn't just our misery. Our worry is not just our worry. Our irritation isn't just our irritation. How many times have you thought you were doing very well at keeping your anger and your irritation and your resentment up inside, and someone comes up to you and says, are you doing okay? You know, are you feeling okay today? And gives you that look, and you say, oh, of course I'm fine. And then you either dissolve in anger or tears, either one. So what we need to realize is that what we do affects everybody else. And although we may not be in a position where we can ease the pain and the troubles in Iraq and Syria and New York and Ferguson and all the other places, we can clean up our own karma. And chances are, if we decide to clean up our karma, that's enough for this lifetime. It's full-time employment. We really don't need anything else. We can do that. So she concludes, and I would like to conclude also. She asked the question, how can I live my life so that when I die, I have no regrets? And the answer that she offers us is, be grateful to everyone. Thank you all very much. Homage to the Buddha. Homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha.